This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with the Palestinian writer and poet Mossab Abu Toa about his harrowing escape from the siege of Gaza. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Did you know that the U.S. Department of Defense is the single largest institutional contributor of greenhouse gas emissions in the world?
And we argue that they have a commensurate responsibility to pay international climate finance to those countries that are most affected by the climate crisis, but least responsible.
It's Tuesday, December 19th, but as you know, every day is Science Friday. I'm Sci-Fi producer Rasha Aridi. Between the fuel consumed by military bases, planes, and ships, plus the process of making and using weapons and clearing land, militaries around the world account for almost 6% of all greenhouse gas emissions. A new report calculated how much two prominent militaries, the US and the UK's, would hypothetically owe if they paid for the damage caused by their carbon emissions. The total? $111 billion. Here's Ira Flato.
Joining me are two authors of the report, Kemra Gailey, senior researcher at Commonwealth, a think tank in London, Dr. Patrick Bigger, research director at the Climate and Community Project, a progressive climate policy think tank. He's based in Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much, Ira.
Thanks for having us.
Patrick, you focused on the U.S. and the U.K. militaries. Why choose those two?
Well, for one thing, we're based in the U.S. and U.K., and so these are policy decisions that we're very concerned with, and also the roles historically of the U.S. and U.K. in really creating and securing the global fossil fuel economy that we've been living with over the past century or so. That's the primary driver of greenhouse gas emissions and associated changes to the climate.
Now, I mentioned that $111 billion figure in climate reparations. How did you get that number? Give me some of the math there.
Sure. So it's not a particularly complicated set of math. What we did was look at the self-reported emissions figures from both the U.S. and U.K. militaries since 2015, which, of course, is the year of the Paris Climate Accord. So a year that, you know, there was real international consensus that something serious needs to be done about the climate crisis. And then we looked at a range of figures for what's called the social cost of carbon, or effectively the damages that would be caused by each excess ton of carbon emissions. And we landed on what we think is a kind of middle of the road figure, around $250 per ton, and applied that to each ton of emissions that the US and UK militaries self-reported. And so that's how we arrived at this figure of $111 billion since 2015.
Ken, was that surprising to you?
I don't think so, just because we were aware of the scale of military emissions, both from the UK and the US, with especially the US and the size of its military a particular concern to us. Actually, as Patrick said, the figure is quite middle of the road. And that's really because the official data on military emissions is so limited. So for the US, we didn't have access to emissions figures for 2022. And with the UK, we didn't have 2017 or 2018. So really, we're working with a limited picture here. And the estimate that we're originally coming to, although it is a reasonably large sum of money, you know, it could be more in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, considering the sizes of military budgets these days, that's not a lot of money, is it?
It really isn't. When we look at, you know, U.S. Department of Defense appropriations this year at around $840 billion, which is annually what the Inflation Reduction Act, which of course is the U.S.'s biggest ever climate investment, what the Inflation Reduction Act will spend over the course of a decade. So we're talking about an order of magnitude more spending annually on the military than on climate action.
Mm-hmm. And Kim, give me an idea where that money would go. Who would get that money?
So what we argue is that that money should go to internationally governed climate finance funds. That's something that through UN processes is already being negotiated, already happening, although the richer countries that have said that they'll be pledging up to $100 billion of climate finance each year have been failing to deliver that. And what we're looking at here is actually a separate internationally governed fund to cater specifically for the effects of military activity, because the militaries are such big polluters. They're you know, huge source of emissions, and they're causing ecological damage in other ways. And that's not something that's been accounted for in UN processes so far.
There's a good case to be made that this money should be distributed broadly across the global south. And because we know that these countries in Latin America and Africa and in Southeast Asia, especially small island developing states in places like the Caribbean and Pacific, are the most vulnerable to climate change for a couple of reasons. One of which, of course, is just that they lack the financial resources to make investment in climate adaptation, as well as in low carbon development, you know, to really chart their own path for the 21st century as the climate crisis intensifies. So there's this dual problem of higher physical vulnerability with lower financial resources to cope. And so there are researchers at the Overseas Development Institute who calculate what the fair share of international climate finance should be based on the historical emissions of the big polluting countries like the US and UK. They find that the US, to hit its fair share, should really be contributing around $44 billion per year in climate finance, which is about four times more than we officially contribute to these processes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk specifically about those countries. Which countries are you talking about?
Sure. There's a very good case that this money should be primarily directed to the poorest countries that are already suffering the impacts of the climate crisis the most while contributing the least. Richer countries like those in Latin America often have access to international financial markets on which they can borrow to undertake climate action, whereas the poorest countries are really dependent or really rely on public climate finance from both the US and UK directly, as well as from international financial institutions like the World Bank and IMF. But the big part of this is that we think that this money should be distributed as grants rather than as loans in order to not add to the financial burdens of countries already grappling with the impacts of the climate crisis.
Mm-hmm. And one of the tenets of the COP28 is the Loss and Damage Fund. Is that what you're talking about?
No, we're actually talking about is an additional separate fund, not for loss and damages to be paid for emissions in, say, the UK and US as a whole, but actually to directly account for the operations of militaries. And one of the reasons that we think that this is a really important area for international climate finance is because militaries are under the control of each government. So these are public sector emissions. In the UK, it's around 50% of public sector emissions come from the military, using official figures. In the US, it's around 80%. So it's a really, really high amount of public sector emissions, and that's something that governments are directly responsible for. And we argue that they have a commensurate responsibility to pay international climate finance to those countries that are most affected by the climate crisis, but least responsible.
If the US and UK militaries actually wanted to reduce their carbon footprint, what's the roadmap? How would they do that, Cam?
So what we found in our research is that both the US and the UK militaries are trying to position themselves now as solutions to the climate crisis rather than contributors to the climate crisis. So what they've both been saying in their policy documents is that on the one hand, they want to preserve global security that they see as being affected by the climate crisis, but also they think that they can decarbonize their existing operations. Now, if you look into the figures, just the official emissions data that we have available, and that is limited, what you see is that the kind of the most prominent sources of emissions are energy use. And what is energy use in a military context? We're talking about fighter jets and warships. Now, fighter jets, to take one example, are not a piece of technology that has a viable decarbonisation pathway at the moment. There isn't a zero emissions fuel option that fighter jets can take on board. And moreover, they're very expensive pieces of technology. The F-35 program's costing the US government $1.7 trillion over its lifetime. So it's very difficult to replace them. So really what we found is that you can't just decarbonize existing military operations, but rather you have to reduce them in size and you have to close the overseas networks of bases that both the US and the UK have.
Yeah. Hasn't the Pentagon, the US Pentagon, already said that climate change is an existential threat to the U.S., specifically the Navy? They have all these bases, San Diego, Norfolk, right there on the water, and you may have rising oceans. I mean, they seem to believe that, don't they?
They absolutely do. I think you could make a very strong case that the Department of Defense has taken climate change as seriously, if not more seriously, than just about any other federal agency, because they realize that the material impacts of climate change will have serious knock-on effects for their day-to-day operations, as well as what sorts of conflicts we see in the 21st century. The way that they speak about it is that climate change is a threat multiplier, and that it won't necessarily produce new conflicts, but it will intensify conflicts and increase their impacts. So they have taken climate change very seriously, but we don't think that it's gone anywhere near far enough.
So it's they recognize the threat, but they're not moving fast enough, is what I hear you saying.
That's right. For a number of reasons, as Kim discussed, especially around the use of aviation fuel, which is far and away the largest component of U.S. military emissions. It's just very hard to see a pathway towards meaningful emissions reductions. And so while the military can invest in things like seawalls at Norfolk at Hampton Roads, or in base electrification at bases across the country, that doesn't really get at the heart of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Back in 2009, Secretary of the Navy Ray Mabus launched a program for the Navy called the Green Fleet. Are you familiar with that? It trying to use renewable fuels for its ships?
Oh, I'm absolutely familiar with that. A colleague and I wrote a paper on precisely this program back in 2017 that was really my introduction to the problem of U.S. military greenhouse gas emissions. And in fact, is why we looked into start quantifying those emissions in the first place, because there wasn't a good figure out there. And so this is one of the very interesting things about the U.S. military, is that historically it's been the one area through which the U.S. government really intervenes in the economy and in making investments in research and development of things like alternative fuels. And so they've been trying to crack this nut for 15 years in terms of coming up with sustainable aviation fuels alternatives. And fortunately, there's just not the scale or volume of these fuels available to make much of a dent anytime in the near term future, nor is it entirely clear when those would become economically viable or cost competitive with existing fuels.
So it's really a political decision.
Absolutely.
To expand it so that it's meaningful. Yeah.
Absolutely. Which is the case with, you know, we understand the science of climate change very well. We understand what the impacts will be to a large extent. And now it's really up to it's a political process to determine what ought to be done and how quickly we can achieve emissions reductions to avert the worst impacts of global warming.
Patrick, you guys have put a number on the figure here. Is there any initiatives on that front to hold militaries accountable, Patrick?
Well, that is precisely the conversation that we are trying to start. And I think reasonable people can certainly debate what the correct number is, but just by having a conversation about what the number is, I think maybe we start to have a conversation about how we could get it done.
Yeah. And Cam, your report says that if we do cut back on the military, we're going to have to find jobs, right, for all those folks put out of work. Where would they go?
Well, exactly. And I think what we see there is that we can really learn from the trade union movement in both the US and in the UK. Because what trade unions have shown us from the 1970s onwards is that actually jobs existing within the military industry at the moment can be converted into new industries. And even in the 70s in the UK, they were proposing at Lucas Aerospace, a defence firm, what workers were proposing to make heat pumps, which now is seen as a very modern green technology. So I think what's really important to think about here is that when we'd be rolling back military operations, we'd also be having to think about what we do with the military industry. In the US, about $400 billion a year is spent on defence contractors. In the UK, it's a much smaller figure, but still significant for the UK, of £30 billion a year spent on equipment for the Ministry of Defence. And if you're cutting back the size of your military, then you really have to have an active strategy and an active plan to convert some of that industrial capacity that exists within the military industry to new green jobs. And that can even be done using the same plants.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, one man's harrowing escape from the siege of Gaza.
It was the first time in my life I see an Israeli soldier, which is, I think, very strange. You have been under bombardment, you have been living under siege and occupation, and you haven't seen any soldier in your life, but you are bombed from the sky.
I'll talk with writer Mossab Abu-Toa on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're talking about military climate reparations, how the U.S. and U.K. militaries would hypothetically owe more than $110 billion if they were going to pay for the damage caused by their carbon emissions. I'm here with the two authors on that report, Cameron Gailey, senior researcher at Commonwealth, a think tank in London, Dr. Patrick Bigger, research director at another think tank, the Climate and Community Project. You know, in this era of climate crisis, I already mentioned how the Pentagon views this as an existential threat and a military threat to the United States. This really is a national security issue, but thought about differently. Is it not, Patrick?
It is. And I think as the climate crisis intensifies, part of what we are hoping that this contributes to is a broader conversation about what is important to achieve security as the climate changes around us, and security for whom, and how we finance the investments that we need to ensure not just security, but, you know, the form of reparations that we think about comes from my collaborator, Dr. Olufemi Taiwo at Georgetown University, who says that reparations should be world-making. That is, they should make different kinds of worlds thinkable and possible. And so by diverting some amount of money from what would otherwise go to, you know, fuel for F-35 training flights or something like this, you know, maybe non-essential military uses, then how can we think about how worlds, especially for people who are particularly vulnerable in the global South, how they become more secure in a highly uncertain future?
You know, the idea about cutting back on the military echoes back 60 years to when President Eisenhower, on his last days in office in 1961, he warned Americans about the increasing power of the military-industrial complex, which is a phrase that came into our vocabulary. And he even warned ecologically. He said, as we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. An irony that Ike, who was the military commander of the Allied forces in World War II, a man who is connected to the military-industrial complex, would warn us. And it seems like that still echoing today, 60 years later.
Incredibly prescient, is it not? And yet it also demonstrates a real problem that I think applies to various dimensions of the climate crisis, that we've known that this is going to be a problem for a long, long time and not taken appropriate action to mitigate our emissions or make the investments in adaptation for the warming we're already locked into. And so maybe we can think back to Ike's warning and see what happened when we didn't heed it, and maybe make some changes about how we respond to those threats that we've already identified.
I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much, Ira.
You're welcome. Cameron Gailey, senior researcher at Commonwealth, a think tank in London, and Dr. Patrick Bigger, research director at the Climate and Community Project, a progressive climate policy think tank. He's based in Maryland.
That's all for today on tomorrow's episode, Material Science and Cocoa Pods. See you tomorrow. I'm Rasha Aridi.